This is Letters on Politics on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Stephen M. Engel now joined me. Stephen M. Engel is Associate Professor and Chair of Politics at Bates College in Maine. He's the author of the book, Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives, and he joins us from the Bates College Digital Media Studio. Stephen Engel, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, very timely book, Fragmented Citizens, and thinking about fragmented citizens when it comes to gays and lesbians in this country. On one hand, in this country, we have some of the most wide-ranging rights for gays and lesbians in this country, but at the same time, we have states like North Carolina where we see those rights being very much infringed. What do you think about this moment in time right now in this country?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think we're at a really interesting moment in the United States with regard to the state of LGBT equality. As you note, on the one hand, we're nearing the one-year anniversary of the Obergefell ruling, which declared bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional. And then on the other hand, we're seeing these repeated attempts to curb other aspects of LGBT equality, like the laws in states that are Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or like HB2 coming out of North Carolina. And I think we tend to view the dynamic of sort of a win and then followed by a loss as a politics of social movement push and then a kind of a counter movement backlash. But I think what we're also seeing illustrates how political change in the United States is always partial. And that's really a key idea animating the book, right? So altering laws in one domain will raise to the surface tensions with law and policy in another domain. So if I might, I could give an example. If we say, like, prior to about 2014, in states where same-sex marriage was legal, you also tended to have in those states employment non-discrimination laws that covered sexual orientation and in some cases gender identity, as well as laws that covered same-sex parenting and adoption. And I think Pennsylvania was the first state where essentially you could be married on Sunday and then subsequently potentially fired on Monday. And I think Obergefell exacerbated that tension. There's no employment protections in over 25 states. There's no bans on discrimination in public accommodations in over 25 states. So laws related to marriage have been altered, but these changes have only highlighted new tensions because there haven't been corresponding changes in either employment law in one domain or in public accommodations, to name another. And so we see these tensions rise to the surface, and they're made manifest in laws like HB2. So the book draws on this dynamic of partial and incomplete policy or legal change as kind of a necessary feature of political development in the United States. And it considers this dynamic in light of the changing ways differing governing institutions have defined what it means to be gay or lesbian, right? So the interplay of these two dynamics, though, on the one hand, this partial change, and on the other hand, this kind of changing way we've actually understood what gay and lesbian identity or sexuality more broadly has been understood over the course of the 20th century, that yields what I've termed the fragmented citizen.
Is the problem that we don't have an overarching law or even, I don't know, constitutional amendment or a Supreme Court ruling that would just put any type of discrimination towards any civic activity to make it illegal?
Well, some might say that we actually have that in place, right? And that is the 14th Amendment with its corresponding protections of equal protection, due process, and privileges and immunities. But how that's been interpreted over the, you know, past 150 or so years, there have been placed limits on that. We see that coming to the fore right now with this question around HB2 in North Carolina as to, for example, whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964 actually covers and bans discrimination against transgender individuals. And the argument is that on the one hand, you could say, well, or the argument has been made, no, it does not, because the category of gender identity is not explicitly listed in the 64 Act, right? So the Act bans discrimination on race and sex. And so the question then becomes, and this is what's been debated most recently, is does discrimination on sex include sexual orientation and gender identity? And I think, you know, a lot of people would say that's a new argument, and it's a one that stretches the meaning of the term sex. But I would argue that it's actually not a new argument. We've been actually talking about discrimination on sex as really grounded in sexual stereotyping. And if we think about it in those terms, that clearly covers sexual orientation insofar as discrimination against someone who is gay or lesbian is grounded in the fact that someone who is gay or lesbian is not corresponding to the stereotypes that we might associate with a biological man or a biological woman. The same as would be covered for, would be true for transgender identity. So I think the laws are actually in place, but the actual naming of definitive categories is not there. So it is subject to interpretation.
I remember in just before the Supreme Court made its decision, and we were expecting it, after oral arguments were made concerning marriage, there was hope that a positive ruling from the court would include extending 14th Amendment constitutional rights to gays and lesbians.
Right.
But that didn't happen in that ruling, even though it legalized marriage.
Right. It sort of happened and it sort of didn't, right? It's covered under what I've been terming in some new work that I've been doing, the kind of dignity framework, right? So if you look at rulings going as far back as Romer v. Evans from 1996, but certainly Lawrence v. Texas and then Windsor in 2013 and the most recent ruling last year, questions of gay and lesbian equality have been kind of captured by this notion of dignity, that laws that discriminate are based on animus, and this animus is basically denying the basic human dignity of gays and lesbians. What didn't happen, and what some people had thought would and had perhaps hoped had happened, is that gays and lesbians would be officially named as a suspect class, right? And if they are a suspect class, that means that the court recognizes them as having suffered a history of discrimination, a history of political powerlessness, and that designation then raises the level of scrutiny applied. So the higher level of scrutiny that a court applies to a particular law, the more likely that the law is not going to sustain constitutional review. And that did not happen. And so some people think that the 14th Amendment really didn't apply in the sense of the traditional way. And in some newer work I've been doing this past spring, it sort of comes out of this book. It really has been making me think about how the gay rights jurisprudence is really actually pushing our concepts of equal protection in very different ways and kind of disrupting this architecture of scrutiny and suspect class that's really been the defining feature of 14th Amendment jurisprudence over the latter half of the 20th century.
So do you need a case now that's specifically going to look at that question of the 14th Amendment and suspect class?
Well, it would be nice if there were, for like academic reasons, if there were a case that would say deal with racial discrimination or sex discrimination in a way that doesn't invoke suspect class status. That would kind of clarify the trajectory of the court. But for example, if we go back to Obergefell, Kennedy's ruling doesn't invoke any of the traditional trappings of suspect class and higher scrutiny, right? And there was, I believe, an interview that I think Slate conducted with Justice Ginsburg, where she had indicated that she might have, if she had written a concurrence, done the more traditional route that state Supreme Courts had done, particularly courts like in Iowa and Connecticut, where they had gone through the traditional categories or characteristics of a suspect class, said gays, lesbians, bisexuals fit these characteristics, they are therefore a suspect class, therefore we raise the level of scrutiny applied, and they applied a level of scrutiny called heightened scrutiny, which is often given to discrimination based on sex. And that kind of decision-making simply did not occur. And it hasn't occurred in the vast majority of recent gay rights cases to come to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court has really been resisting the application of the scrutiny doctrine.
Can there be a case, though, that specifically forces this upon the court, that the court would have to tackle that issue?
Well, it would be interesting to see, for example, if a case arose out of HB2, for example, and say, you know, a student brought a lawsuit saying that this violates equal protection, or an individual brought a lawsuit that violates equal protection and their rights to privacy under due process and the 14th Amendment, there could clearly be a case that would rise. But because of the gay rights jurisprudence, the case, again, need not be decided through this traditional architecture. We could very easily imagine a case that Kennedy might sign on to where it would say, well, HB2 is written for no rational basis. There's no legitimate reason why that the state has argued to support this law. Therefore, it could only be motivated by animus. Therefore, it is unconstitutional. That kind of decision is really the kind of decision that the gay rights jurisprudence, going back to at least Lawrence, has mapped out. And the question is whether that's a new trajectory or whether it's just somehow unique to the gay rights decisions. I think that's, you know, we would have to see more cases on 14th Amendment issues to see if the court's actually headed in a new jurisprudential direction.
Again, we are in conversation with Stephen M. Engel. He's the author of the book Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. This dynamic that we're looking at today, Stephen Engel, is this a new dynamic, or do you see iterations of it and maybe perhaps look a little bit different, but fundamentally a similar dynamic that goes back decades?
Oh, I think this definitely goes back decades. What the book is really about is tracing how different governing authorities, and by that I mean different levels of government, municipal government, state government, the federal government, but also different branches, courts, legislators, executives, as well as administrative state bureaucrats. And even there's a little part of the book that looks at how our lives are regulated by private sector actors like human resource managers, how the way in which we have defined human sexuality and particular gay and lesbian sexuality has changed over the course of the 20th century. So the book really begins at the latter decades of the 19th century and kind of traces this developmental dynamic whereby we kind of different governing authorities have defined the meaning of gay and lesbian identity differently. So, for example, in the early part of the 20th century, in the progressive era, as homosexuality was coming to be discovered by scientists and physicians and kind of defined, it was really by government officials, it was considered a threat to national community. And so we see it made manifest in immigration regulations, in civil service regulations. That's really part and parcel with other restrictive regulations like the Chinese Exclusion Acts that really define the progressive era. And what's interesting about that, a friend and colleague of mine at Princeton, Margot Kennedy, has written an excellent book, The Straight State, where she goes into how immigration officials at the turn of the 20th century did not have the vocabulary to actually understand what they were seeing as either sexual transgression or gender identities that didn't seem to correspond to expectation. And they didn't really know what this was. So they were using existing ways to keep these people out of the United States. They would be called public charges. And so that meant that they would likely become wards of the state, unable to function in the workplace, dependent on the state. We don't want these people in here. They threaten our national community. Let's not let them in. And it's over the course of the 20th century that the vocabulary to actually define what does it mean when we say there's a homosexual person, what does that look like? That's really defined by the mid-20th century. And then as the century goes on, we see sort of different, what I call in the book, modalities or dispositions that a given governing authority might take towards defining sexuality. So, for example, are gays and lesbians a class of persons subject to unjust discrimination? Or as we saw by the late 90s and early 2000s, gays and lesbians might be a class of persons wholly decriminalized, but otherwise kind of privatized and kept out of sight of the state, right? They're just not seen by governing authorities or at all. And so what I'm trying to explore is that, in fact, this is a dynamic that doesn't just change over time. It's not just that old prejudices give way. It's that depending on the governing authority with which you're interacting, that governing authority might see you in a very different way, depending on the policy issue you're dealing with, or depending on the authority and official that you're dealing with. So another kind of basic example, we can take it from my own life, right? So in the late 1990s, I was living in Arlington, Virginia, and I was working for a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. And so depending on the authority with which I interacted, I was either a latent criminal because the state of Virginia criminalized consensual same-sex sexual relations, right? But the city of Arlington, I'm not quite sure, but say, for example, if they had had a domestic partnership registry, I could have a legally recognized partner at the municipal level. And then certainly my workplace offered a policy of non-discrimination based on sexual orientation in hiring and promotion. And they also offered healthcare benefits if I had a partner, right? So my status fundamentally changed and was contingent on which authority governed me at a particular time or with which I interacted or what issue I was dealing with, whether it's employment or healthcare or parenting, right? And so this is what I mean when I say that the citizenship status is fragmented, right? It's basically contingent, not just it changes over time, but it can differ at the same time depending on the policy issue you're dealing with or depending on the actual governing authority that you're dealing with.
Well, this fragmentation then makes me think about, again, what's happening today in states like North Carolina and a few other states that have adopted anti-homosexual laws. Couldn't it be argued, say, I'm broadcasting from California, where it'd be illegal to discriminate in the same way as somebody from California now suddenly goes to North Carolina and faces certain types of discrimination? And I guess I think, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a professor, I'm just a radio guy, which doesn't go for a whole lot, but I think of the Interstate Commerce Clause that gives the federal government its authority to enact laws upon states when commerce crosses, you know, states. That's how the federal government gets its authority for many of the laws that it does. It seems like to me there would be a role here for the federal government to institute a uniformed standard.
Yeah, I think what that butts up against is our kind of traditional notion of federalism, right? So we've got kind of different dynamics happening that define our constitutional culture in the U.S. So on the one hand, we have 50 states. We have a culture of where federalism is understood to encourage policy experimentation, that there's certain benefits to not having uniformity so that, you know, different states can try out different ways to solve a particular policy issue. And then if one way works, other states might follow. So there's certainly a kind of history of federalism. And then there's a darker history associated with that, which is, you know, the discourse of states' rights, which is often associated with either slavery in the Civil War or resistance to African-American civil rights and equal protection in the mid-20th century. And so what we have here is a kind of democratic principle of federalism and states' rights butting up against another democratic principle of equal treatment. And I think when I teach constitutional law to my students, I think one of the things that is remarkable in the U.S. As compared to some other countries is we don't think of our Constitution as changing dramatically over time.
Stephen M. Engel has been our guest. Again, Stephen M. Engel is a professor at Bates College, and he's the author of the book, Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Lives of Gay and the Changing Landscapes of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Again, that's Stephen M. Engel. And that does it for Letters M.